Okay, good afternoon all. For our final session of the day, we did save the best for last. So we want to introduce Peter Zaffino, CEO of AIG. We'll start with some introductory comments and then we'll jump to Q&A.
Thanks, Mario. Good afternoon, everybody. I just wanted to take a few minutes just to make some introductory comments, and then I look forward to spending some time with Mario and some of the questions from the group. It's great to be back here. We appreciate the opportunity to spend some time and present to you. In many ways, 2025 has been a real pivotal year for AIG. One of our defining moments, we talk a lot about it, was at Investor Day in March. We set out a few key objectives there, which is really important for this year, is we really wanted to put the past of AIG behind us. Wanted to spend quite a bit of time providing more details on the company we are today, and I'm sure we'll talk more about that over the next hour, and demonstrate the positive impact, the work our colleagues have done to reposition the company. We highlighted and wanted to emphasize a few very important things, which were our underwriting culture. We've developed operational excellence, and that's been from driving end-to-end process to digitizing workflow to what we're doing today with Gen AI. And of course, executing on a very disciplined capital management strategy. All of that has given us a lot of financial and strategic flexibility for today. We also wanted to introduce, not capabilities, but more of what we were doing in terms of Gen AI. And actually, he's received a lot of attention since Investor Day, and I'm sure we'll talk about it today. We outlined ambitious long-term financial targets, and we remain on track to achieve those. If I could spend a few minutes just highlighting the second quarter, adjusted after-tax income per share increased 56% year over year, and that was driven by underwriting income, which increased 46%. Our core operating ROE increased to 11.7% in the quarter, and our calendar year combined ratio was 89.3%, so we thought that was an outstanding result for the second quarter. For the first half of the year, our EPS growth is tracking slightly above of the three-year objective we talked about of the 20%, notwithstanding a lot of cat activity, the wildfires in the first quarter. So, we're really pleased with the progress we've made through the first 6 months. We also returned $4.5 billion of capital to shareholders, year-to-date through the second quarter, and delivered a third consecutive year of double-digit dividend growth. We also reached another significant milestone. S&P and Moody's upgraded the financial strength of our insurance company subsidiaries. And it's worth noting, this is the first upgrade that AIG received from Moody's since 1990. We had to go back quite a ways. And so that was, quite an achievement for us. We retired an additional $830 million of debt in the second quarter. Now have a debt to total capital ratio of 17.9%, which is one of the best in the industry. We did talk a lot about, on the recent earnings call, the rate environment. I'm sure we'll cover it today. But generally speaking, property has had, headwinds in 2025. Casualty's actually been strong, particularly in excess casualty. And financial lines has finally flattened out after a period of rate reduction. Property, I spent a decent amount of time talking about actually, what are the components of property pricing and how you actually derive the rate making and how do you drive profitability? What's the impact of reinsurance? How do you look at AALs? And wanted to make sure that we emphasize the level of diligence that we do in making sure we have a fully loaded, cat cost, and all of our property costs are, very transparent and we know how they move depending on market conditions. So we're well positioned to manage through this environment, focus on growth opportunities, but most importantly, underwriting profitability. Before I shift to Q&A, I just do want to share a couple of comments on Gen AI. It's been a key focus for us. We want to embed it into our core business and end-to-end processes supporting underwriting and claims. The early results have been very promising. At Investor Day, I spoke about what were really aspirations. We had some pilots, we had some rollouts, but quite frankly, getting some of the tech leaders to join us and talk about what they thought was the work that we're doing. But in many ways, we've actually made more progress than what I thought we could do from when I outlined this originally in March, just because of the rollout, tech advancements, have been significant. And so we've rolled out a few pilots. It was started, years ago, but a lot of companies are still testing. We're actually live now on things, and so I think that was important, to mention. We started to roll out a component part of our financial lines, and within the year, we'll be rolling out our E&S business, which is Lexington, and then we expect to deploy more of the commercial business in 2026. I do want to leave you with a sense of how fast things are moving. Some of the tech companies and hyperscalers are really driving the pace of innovation at a significant level. Their commitments are substantial in terms of CapEx. I mean, combined Microsoft, Meta, Alphabet, and Amazon announced their intent to spend over $400 billion in CapEx on AI just this year. So I think in 2026, we ought to see this acceleration in terms of not only what we're planning, but new horizons as we start to roll all of this out. So those are just some of the highlights. I know, coming after a second quarter, maybe not a lot of new information, but I just wanted to emphasize all the progress that we're making, executing incredibly well, momentum into the second half of the year. So that's what I just wanted to say for prepared comments. And then, Mary, maybe I'll just transfer over to you for some Q&A.
Perfect. I should point out two things. One, that Peter's providing an update every year, and every year the update is dramatically beyond where it was the prior year. So there's been a tremendous amount going on there. Related to that also, I think my question list is going to be all over the place because, again, there are so many things going on at AAG that are worth talking about. So let me start with one. We spent a lot of time talking about talent and recruitment. You recently announced that John Neal is joining AIG as president. What does the president of AIG do, and what should we, on the investment side, expect from John?
Well, I was the president, so I'd say we actually did quite a bit. So he's got some...
Well, what's left?
John's one of the top executives in the insurance business. I've known him for a very long time. Actually, when I was at Guy Carpenter, I used to work with John before he even took over QBE on a lot of the reinsurance that he is. So I've known him very well for a long period of time. He's incredibly capable. He's had some unbelievable experiences, whether it's running QBE or most recently running Lloyd's. I talked to some of the investors earlier today. I think there's not a lot of companies that are really global and have a broad footprint, but John actually has a lot of global experience, so he's going to fit incredibly well within AIG. Strong track record of underwriting, strategy. He's kept incredibly relevant with all of the moving trends and has a tremendous following. So he's going to give us a lot of bandwidth in terms of the path in which we are going to continue our underwriting journey, but he can do so much more than that. He's really well known, so he'll be, working with a lot of our stakeholders, whether it's investors, regulators, reinsurers, and expect great things from him. And he's very additive to a very capable team that we already have. So we're anxious for him to join us later this year.
Right, and it's November.
Technically, it's December.
Okay.
I'll leave it at that.
Fair enough. That's good enough for my perspective.
I'm good at getting people to work before they're on the payroll.
When you talk about, AIG Next, another success in terms of like getting ahead of plan, both in terms of time and amount, you talked about not just cost savings, but also increasing internal efficiencies where you could process business faster. And some of this may get back to the agentic AI, but can you update us on where those efficiencies are playing out?
The original plan for AIG Next was actually mostly just cost takeout. We actually had said on some of our earnings calls that it's not going to be like AIG 200. We had 10 different operational programs, and the baseline for AIG 200 was to improve the company. This was about getting rid of redundancy, getting a parent company expense structure that fit with the size of the organization that we are. But we had some very terrific observations and insights. Actually, Mia Tarpey, who's here today, actually led AIG Next, and we saw halfway through that there's a lot of things we can do on the operational side that can improve the organization, in addition to getting costs out or costs into the business, and that was connecting a lot of the functions, better end-to-end process, allowing opportunities for better insight on data, and also what we're able to do on Gen AI today is based on the end-to-end connectivity of the organization. And a lot of that was done through AIG Next. So it ended up being a continuation of AIG 200, which was terrific because we had originally just planned for cost takeout, but we were able to improve the company significantly during that period of time.
Okay, and in your introductory comments, you talked about agentic AI being expanded to other product lines. When you said Lexington, is that every line of business that Lexington writes?
Yes, it'll be predominantly, it may not be every single line, but it's gonna be the property and casualty, which is, and financial lines, which will be the predominant portion of it.
What are the data points that you track to demonstrate that it's working as expected?
Well, we focused on, and again, I'll try not to make the answer too long, but when we had embarked on this journey, it was all about how do you take in, you know, data structured and unstructured? How do you actually use data sources that you're not using today? How do you equip an underwriter with more underwriting criteria, and how do you reduce the cycle time substantially to be more efficient and to be able to look at submission flow and workflow to be able to drive growth? And then, you know, we didn't spend a lot of time on this in Investor Day, but we've been doing this. It's evidenced through what we did with Blackstone and Lloyd's and creating a special purpose vehicle for our own reinsurance, is how do you allocate capital and optimize a portfolio? So like, how do you connect all of that together? Lexington became a very big opportunity for us because, you know, we showed that the submission count, and it's still happening in E&S, you know, yes, there's been a rate environment and property that's coming off, but quite frankly, it's been coming off in a lot of the, you know, property market admitted as well. But submissions are still flowing in through non-admitted and through excess and surplus lines. The volume is very hard to handle when you start getting into hundreds of thousands of increased submissions. For our, you know, own business, and whether we were not efficient at the beginning or you know, where we are today, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about that. What I do know is we have 10 times the amount of submissions as we once did, and you're not going to bring in 10 times the amount of underwriters. So, and then you look back to what's the bind to sort of submitted ratio, and it was 6%. Like, so it's not as though it's 20 and it's like, oh, you want to get it to 25 or 30. That might feel hard. When the volume started to increase, when the business started to get more demand, our bind ratios went to 2%. And so, yes, maybe we're more selective underwriters, but 2% of what you're seeing seems largely inefficient. And we felt that getting that data and getting things more prioritized and having the underwriting cycle time decrease is going to allow us to grow significantly in that business. So that became the next evolution in terms of scale, which we should be able to have it done before year end. And as we said, if we can just get back to our old bind ratio, it's north of $1 billion of growth. And I think that that would be a low bar for us, what I think we can do over time.
Okay, fantastic. Are there bottlenecks in terms of rolling it out even more broadly to every AIG region, every AIG line?
I wouldn't say bottlenecks, but you know, how much change do you want to go through in an organization? I think we'll be very aggressive in terms of the rollout in 2026. What you have to realize is that even since March, you know, the companies that I mentioned, I'd add in Palantir, Anthropic, you know, other companies that are pivotal to, you know, our partnerships, they've accelerated their capabilities in the last 6 months. It's unbelievable. And how they can extract data, where they can extract it from, what we've seen is a lot more discussion around agents or individual large language models that can do specific tasks, and how do you actually roll that out. So I'm very optimistic that the rollout does not need to be as linear, and that you can do it in multiple parts of the business at once, and that's what we plan on doing in 2026. You do need, you know, look, we're not having it make decisions for underwriters, but you need the underwriters, you know, if I would say not a bottleneck, but a significant amount of heavy lift work is, if an underwriter is looking at 100, 125 pieces of data, what are those? And what are the, you know, best sources that you can get in terms of property data or casualty data or financial data? And one of the, I think, significant advancements that the large language models have made is that you can now find out where the source is coming from. So in other words, you get financial statements that came from, you know, a rating agency, or came from something that's credible versus something that may be scraped that you don't know where it came from. And that's where there was more hallucinations. So I think the data accuracy is better. I think the underwriting criteria is better. The issue, it's not a problem, it's an issue to be aware of, is that how much of these large language models become intuitive and how much further do they go in an organization than what you're asking them to do. If you start to implement a lot of different large language models at once, that ontology gets super complicated. And so we're working through that as well to make sure that we understand the rollout. Again, it's not making decisions, but making certain that the organization can catch up to how we want to operate in the future.
Okay, fantastic. When you look forward 5 years, this is it maybe not a great question. Can AI make underwriting decisions, not today, in 5 years?
I think they will be able to. What type of decisions and what you want them doing is really the question. But even today, a simple example would be, looking at sprinkler systems. Is it water, or is it suck the oxygen out of the room, or is it foam, or knowing how to train large language models as to what's a better outcome mm-hmm. on some of the sub components of underwriting, I think will be very important and very helpful.
Okay, so to me that sounds like maybe the prioritization that you talked about, where the best submissions are at the top, that gets more refined.
Submissions at the top and information that could be more binary in terms of how you train an agent, I think can be very helpful to the underwriting process.
Okay, fantastic. You also mentioned the rating agency upgrades. Practically speaking, there's nothing, I don't see anything wrong with those. What difference will those make?
I mean, for our business, probably nothing. I mean, but from a perspective of this journey of, bringing all of our stakeholders along, we had to get, an underwriting portfolio that was one of the worst performers to get to a, top performer. We had to get, limit management. We had to develop operational excellence. We had to bring, we were getting no, ordinary dividends out of our subsidiaries because the regulatory environment was one where AIG had just disappointed. So it was kind of the last stakeholder that had not sort of voted for the change and the improvement that we made, and to see that affirmation. And then going back and saying, 1990, I was a trainee at the Hartford, and there's no such thing as cell phones, voicemail. The world was different back then, so that's a long time. And so it was just more of symbolic of, we've come a long way, people are proud of it, and it was just another last sort of vote in terms of, yes, we believe in all the things you're doing, and we believe in the financial strength of the company. So it was a good moment for the company.
Yeah, no, I didn't in any way.
But no, in terms of trading, it won't matter.
Okay, right.
But we're gonna keep telling everybody we got upgrades since 1990. I like that.
It's a great line. Heading to Monte Carlo soon. Start talking about reinsurance. AIG buys a lot of property reinsurance. We're in a presumably softening part of the property reinsurance cycle. So I know the timing of this question isn't great, but is AIG over-reinsured? Are there ways of optimizing that? Or do we take advantage of declining pricing to further benefit shareholders, benefit the company?
Over-reinsured, under-reinsured, it is a strategy and a philosophy. Each company has a sort of a different view. If you're running a business, in a global business, that is running in a low 80s combined ratio with what would be technically considered a lot of reinsurance, I like that strategy. I like the predictability of volatility containment. And I don't like to be at the whim of what happens with the weather or a major hurricane or wildfires. We have a risk tolerance. And that's how we set up the entire company. When the market started to change a lot a couple of years ago, we stuck really hard with lower retentions because, again, it was within that volatility containment. And you either load the cost in, for the reinsurance, or you don't. My own view is that, and I tried to break this down because I get a lot of questions around this in the second quarter, which was how do you actually break out the components of property? And, I have this philosophical argument, I'll stay away from it, but why would reinsurance costs be that much more expensive than retaining it yourself? I mean, you could take There could be a couple of philosophies. One is, well, I'm not going to take a single year view. I'll take a 5-year view. Okay, well, that's been wrong each of the last 5 years. It's been higher than what would have been predicted. So that doesn't seem like the right way to play it. There's a cost of capital issue. Somebody has too much of a margin. Like whatever, that's in the eye of the beholder. But my view is it should be like fully loaded into the cost. And so if you think about a market that we're going into, what I try to break out is that a reduction in reinsurance costs benefits us because that is embedded into our product. If you just funded it net as an AAL, you don't reduce your AAL because the reinsurance market's going down. That's your expected losses and that has to stay the same. So if the rates are coming down, and you don't have anything to offset that, like reinsurance, like that's not coming down commensurate, then you have to have margin compression and a meaningful amount of margin compression because you still have the same cat net, mm-hmm. you still have your same risk net, and if you're getting total premium coming off the top, well, that has to still fund that, so it goes really into your attritionals. If our sort of cost of goods sold, I call it, is that of reinsurance is coming down at or more than the original pricing, well then really I'm only focusing on the attritional, same thing on the risk, is that then it's much more manageable because that cat cost, which would be self-funded with AAL otherwise, mm-hmm. is coming down, and so we get the same benefit for lower cost.
Right.
And so I think like in a market, look at, I don't root for an active cat season or a benign one, we manage through the cycle. But if the reinsurance costs are going to go down, that benefits us and doesn't put as much pressure on pricing as it would if you kept, you know, substantially large nets.
Right. Okay, no, that makes a lot of sense. This is only tenuously related to that concept, but I've had this thesis for a while that when we look at lines of business where pricing has gone soft over the last few years, so D&O, cyber, most recently property, there's been a suddenness to those decreases compared to past cycles. And I know it's a mistake to assume that cycles would be identical, they're not. But how, if that premise is true, that cycles manifest themselves faster, how does that impact your ability to plan for the consolidated AIG?
You have to look at each line of business on its own merits. And you know, the topic right now is property. And you have to look at the cumulative effects of that. And so you have to have a plan there. I mean, in other words, with property, like the cumulative rate increases have been north of 100%. Combined ratios have been excellent. You can, you know, look at, for us, we have so many different points of entry into the property market, whether it's through admitted in the United States or non-admitted through the United States or through Europe or through Asia. We can hub in Singapore. We see it through Lloyd's. So there's so many different places, and you want to take a look at, you don't want to manage it as an index, but there's opportunities in different parts of the world at different times. And so the planning is really what's going to happen if the rate environment is going to be down like we've seen in property. Well, okay, what kind of margin do you have? What type of combined ratios do you have, and can we manage through it? I think you also have to take a look at where you are in the market. Are you lead in pricing? Are you setting the terms? Or are you just capacity following outcomes? That becomes a different outcome. And then you have to have a point of view as to how long you can sustain that. So I think, is the property market more aggressive in terms of some of the pricing coming off than we would have thought at the beginning of the year? Yes, it is. Dramatically, no, but a little bit more. And so, we will see how it plays out through the rest of the year, but we have perhaps a different plan in 26 if the rate environment continues. In financial lines, we do the same thing, which is, we reduced our writings when there started to become cumulative rate increases in commoditized layers, high excess, mid excess, and we just started to non-renew business. And there'll always be pockets of where there's opportunities for growth. We're seeing that in casualty now, non-admitted as well as admitted. I think some of the specialty classes have had some pressure on pricing, but again, the same dynamics as our property book, which has had really strong combined ratios. And then you have to be prepared to grow when there's opportunities that exist in the marketplace from either dislocations or opportunities in different parts of the world and geography. So that's part of the planning process, and I think we're in a really good place in terms of understanding what the economics are for each of the lines of business that we trade in.
Right.
Okay, fantastic. I did want to look around the room if there are questions. I want to make sure that you're getting the information that you need out of this session, so please raise your hand if you do have a question, and we'll get the mic to you. In the absence of that, so another large commercial CEO has suggested, and
who?
Evan.
I need to know.
Has suggested that bigger companies are positioned to grow faster. And the backdrop to this question is we've seen huge market share concentration in personal lines among the biggest companies, some of whom became bigger because of skill, but that dynamic has played out. We haven't really seen it in commercial lines. And the suggestion is that because of a number of factors, we should see that basically better growth at bigger companies. Are you seeing that? Do you expect that? How are you addressing that potentiality?
I think over time, I think that will happen. I don't know that we're seeing it right now because, you know, again, it's always what you see in this marketplace where, you know, either some MGAs or capacity that has come in that needs premium, needs volume, until something happens that tempers a little bit of the growth. But I think over time, scale is going to matter significantly, in some ways more than it ever has, whether it's balance sheets, ability to have diversified growth, quality and expertise in underwriting to be able to scale a business. But, and I'm trying not to make every answer about Gen AI, but I think in 3 years, businesses that have invested, the pendulum is going to push those much, further, faster. And those who have not been able to, ingest and be able to accelerate, cycle time will be, I think, very much disadvantaged. And you have to have scale to make those investments. You have to have expertise in order to be able to operationalize it. And I think, larger companies with scale are going to benefit from all of that significantly.
Okay. When you look at your competitor base, and I'm asking this because I don't get the sense that you compete a lot with smaller regionals writing small standard commercial policies. How do you see your advantages playing out there?
You know, the footprint for every large insurance company is a bit different. And so it's in pockets. I mean, obviously in London, it's a big specialty. We're one of the world's largest specialty underwriters. And so we're competing with Lloyd's, we're competing with other large insurance companies that may have some expertise in specialty classes, but I think we are the most, sort of prominent amongst, organizations in terms of size, scale, expertise. I believe that. In the U.S., it's a little bit more in terms of how we scale. We've done an amazing job with Lexington in terms of its relevance to the marketplace and size and scale. So we have some, formidable competitors there, but I do think that there's a way that you bifurcate that with size, expertise, and ability to grow. Versus more, commoditized. It's not all large, players, but there are, specialty insurers that compete in that area that really differentiate themselves, and Lexington is one of them. I mentioned property in the many ways in which we can access, property from so many different parts of the world. We have a very different business in Asia. I mean, we're the world's largest non-domestic insurance company in Japan, where we haven't fully seen all of the benefits and I think potential of that business with some of our personal insurance, particularly A&H, and some of the digital investments we're making there to fuel growth that will be on the come. India, I know it's not a consolidated business, but it's a big business and one that we think has one of the biggest growth potentials in terms of value, size, relevance, and also when it gets out of its domestic sort of capacity, meaning it can actually do, global business through the network of AIG, that can be very advantageous for us as well. So we compete, with a lot of different companies and a lot of different geographies, but really I believe bring expertise and, value differentiation in the markets that we trade.
Okay, that is very helpful. You've talked about, in the context of M&A, certainly an openness to M&A with credibly strict hurdles for financial, cultural, and strategic upside. So the financial and cultural, I think, would very much depend on a potential acquisition. Can you talk about where there could be strategic advantages to AIG from M&A?
Well, I think we've demonstrated through a lot of the work that we've done in restructuring the company that, you know, we would know how to embed an organization, deal with the operational complexities, and get that, you know, synergies that needed to be realized very quickly, but also, you know, embed an organization to be able to make certain that they are more benefited from being part of AIG than not. And that's dependent on a lot of different things. You know, I talk about like there may be segments we're not in and SME, geographies that are additive to our global, you know, network, more scale in businesses where we already have size. A&H would be a great example if we could find something that, you know, we thought was high quality that we could bolt onto a big business that's profitable, that we could accelerate. That would be, you know, something that's very additive. But I think that there's a lot of, I keep mentioning a lot of strategic and financial flexibility. You know, I want to be patient, which doesn't mean wait forever, but I want to make sure that whatever we do acquire is strategic, is ROE accretive, but also is a better fit for them and for us being together. And I think depending on the market and depending on the challenges of growth, that may come earlier or later, depending on what happens with market conditions.
Okay. So if I can just follow up to that, should we think about that strategic benefit as making AIG better or AIG making other businesses better consolidated within?
Both.
Okay.
That would be our hope.
All right. One issue that's come up a lot, and I like this issue because it gives me the opportunity to talk about something besides pricing, and on the sell side, that's 95% of my conversations, is speed of processing for smaller applications. And I'm asking this question really in the context of Western world. How does it compare, and what are its prospects for developing further competitive advantages on speed and accuracy of response to brokers?
So Western world, for those who don't know, is part of you know, our excess and surplus lines business. It's really services the, you know, small end of commercial, and it's done remarkably well. Whether it's been new products, its speed to bind is very impressive, and, you know, developing a risk appetite, but also an ease of doing business in terms of ingesting data. We know what our risk appetite is in those businesses, and it's actually penetrating into a market that we really haven't had, you know, much presence. So I think the framework of that, you know, business is great. The strategy is evolving, and our execution has been very good. That's why sometimes the submission count there and the flow and growth has been tremendous. But I think in this, you know, world that we're in and that we're going to be competing with in the future, it's only going to get better.
Okay, fantastic. And that's, again, you said you don't want to use AI as the answer to everything, but it's going to have broad relevance.
AI can help decision-making there a little bit more just because it's, you know, much more small commercial. The volatility around decision-making is not going to be great, and so hopefully we'll be able to advance it. But even today with the technology we have, it does serve our distribution very well because they can bind things, you know, in minutes, and so like getting to seconds doesn't really matter, but making sure that we can continue to enhance our ability to expand risk appetite when we want to, or, you know, focus on specific industries and be able to target those submissions better.
Okay, fantastic. I do want to scan the room again just to see if there are questions. I don't want to make sure I'm not overlooking them. Quick question on underwriting and claims talent, and maybe other segments that I'm not thinking about also, but whether we're talking about the relentless formation of MGAs, whether they're talking about brokers looking for talent, whether we're talking about underwriters, there does seem to be an elevated battle for talent right now, and I was hoping you could talk about where AIG participates. What do you do to attract, to retain, and from a different perspective, to develop talent so that you have superior underwriting and that persists? Or claims handling,
We don't have the same dynamic as brokers do, where, you know, teams get lifted out, or you know, there's significant you know, war for talent in terms of groups of people, because, you know, I think underwriting is different in that maybe business travels with brokers, but it doesn't travel with underwriters. So I think you have a real opportunity to develop the culture that you want in an underwriting organization. We've done a remarkable job with, you know, just terrific leadership that we have within AIG, great practitioners. You know, we had to add a lot of underwriters in, you know, 18, 19, 20. We have a tremendous training program, and so, you know, getting out of university into our analyst program, and then getting you know, individuals working through you know, the overall company has been tremendous, and so we supplement you know, what we bring in from the outside with you know, talent that is developed within AIG, and so we're always looking for ways in which, you know, we can train and advance and enhance the skill sets that we have within the organization. And that means actually training, you know, to where the business is going, not where it's been.
Right.
But yeah, we're always like, we're always gonna be in the war for talent. You know, retaining, attracting. Look at AIG, I don't fully understand it, to be honest, is like, it gets the headlines for everything. I mean, there's been people that have left, I'm like, who is that? Like, I mean, it just gets headlines. And so our attrition's been very low. Our underwriters are very attractive in the industry, just based on the experience that they've gotten in a sort of once of a career opportunity to work through a turnaround and, you know, underwrite portfolios, be part of that. But I've been incredibly pleased with you know, the quality of what we have, the culture we've developed, and our ability to attract talent is tremendous.
Okay. And that attraction flow, if that's the right word, how does that compare, not to 5 years ago when you really needed to rebuild the bench, but like 2 or 3 years ago?
We have been very selective because it's really important, you know, now that we have, you know, there's different skills needed to re-underwrite a portfolio than to grow a portfolio or to, you know, be in an underwriting group that's not going through that level of, you know, rapid change. We're always looking to fill in technical expertise, you know, depending on, like, in London and Lloyd's, there's, you know, different classes of areas where we want to compete that we're, you know, adding and supplementing talent. But generally speaking, it's very specific as to knowing positions that, you know, we want to develop. I mean, look, AI is a big one right now, is bringing in people from, you know, different industries. You know, we just brought in somebody to be the chief digital officer, Scott Hallworth, who is, you know, got a lot of banking experience in terms of being a chief digital officer, but he was the chief actuary of Travelers. Mm-hmm. You know, so coming in with a totally different lens of, you know, financial services, but being grounded in, you know, data and how our business operates, that's been a tremendous and will be addition to the organization. And so finding, you know, different capabilities that complement where we are today is a big part of what we're doing.
Okay. And no $200 million signing bonuses?
No.
Okay, fair enough.
No.
On the MGA side, you guys do have a little bit of delegated underwriting authority. Yeah. How do you manage that? I know, I think there's investor concern that's probably a little exaggerated right now, but it does require a slightly different administrative skill, and I was hoping you could talk about the AIG approach.
Yeah, we don't do a ton of delegated authority. That is not a priority. You're right, it's a different, you know, requirement in terms of skill set. You know, Gladfelter was a company of a great example where they were writing on behalf of, you know, another insurance company at the time, but like they had their own capital. Mm-hmm. They considered themselves an underwriting company, and their track record, you know, proved that. But they also had a distribution, you know, in terms of voluntary firemen that was, and you couldn't really penetrate it. So do you want that expertise within the organization? So that was an example of an acquisition. I think we use the same criteria for, you know, where we would do, you know, MGAs or MGUs. Companies with experience, track record, skin in the game, alignment in terms of underwriting outcomes, not looking to drive top line growth at the expense of underwriting profitability. And you'd rather do it with fewer than sort of spreading it out and watching it very carefully, to be honest, because, you know, that can, and it's happened to AIG and many other companies in the past where, you know, that can go pear-shaped pretty quickly in a market where you don't have a real accurate view of what, you know, the accident year loss ratios are, the growth and, you know, the development of the book of business. So I think there's been a lot of delegated authority. In my view, it's gonna, you know, end in tears over time for for some of the organizations, but that, you know, unfortunately in our business takes a little bit of time.
Right. I mean, that's, I would argue that that's true even on the traditional side with maybe slightly misaligned incentives.
Yes.
I want to spend a little bit of time focusing on reserves, really from two perspectives. We did have some older accident year strengthening in the second quarter, and I want to get a sense of your comfort for other legacy mass torts, for lack of a better word. And then one point that I think got under, that's been underappreciated, is the fact that when we look at your quarterly results, and this is true, even in the second quarter, there's favorable development, and it's favorable development besides ADC amortization, or ADC gain amortization. Yeah. So I wanted to talk about those two. I know they're somewhat contradictory, but they are two different realms.
We're very focused on making sure that we continue to strengthen the balance sheet. We take a very conservative view on reserves. I wouldn't read into the back years at all. Nothing emerged. There was nothing that said, you know, we have to do something on mass tort. We decided to do it have built some conservatism into that. You know, we've been very focused, and I've said this on, you know, the first quarter call, where we built in some margin in some of our accident year loss picks, not from emergence, not from concerns on the accident year loss ratios, but just, you know, being conservative in terms of our view of the current environment. There was the ADC amortization, a little bit of release. But again, I think that was all, you know, very orderly. We've been doing it quarter after quarter. And Keith is spearheading, you know, a little bit of more of getting away from these DVRs and looking at, you know, reserves in a more thorough way every quarter. Yes, there'll be deep dives in certain quarters on lines of business, but just getting a much more balanced view, you know, throughout the year instead of, you know, waiting for the third quarter or waiting for certain quarters for, you know, certain lines of business. We've been working, you know, hard on that since the end of last year. And I think it's just patience and, you know, making certain that, you know, we are, you know, watching emergence of each of the accident years. We study Schedule P probably, I mean, I don't want to compare us to other companies, but, you know, what has happened to the industry, you know, of whether it's other liability or other areas where there's long tail, you know, sort of claims activity, and watching, you know, that emergence and watching our own. I mean, you know, our absolute, you know, loss ratios are so much higher because they needed to be based on, you know, some of the, you know, the underwriting that happened in the past. But, you know, we are looking at a variety of different metrics to make sure that, you know, we're being conservative and observant of what's happening in the industry.
Okay, fantastic. And again, I want to look around just to make sure that I'm not overlooking anything. One, there's some new occasional news articles on a shift of longer tail casualty policies to more of a claims made basis, because it's not that much in the short term that the industry can do about social inflation, but you can reduce the tail size, which would limit the compounding risk associated with that. How tenable is that? How much of AIG's book could and should be written on a claims made basis that hasn't been so far?
Well, I mean, you pointed out the benefits of doing claims made. I don't know that, you know, in the segments that we trade in, that clients are going to be as receptive to claims made as we may like, you know. And, sure. And certainly when you're underwriting, you know, an occurrence form that has like a really long tail, that making sure that you have the appropriate, you know, pricing for what could be, you know, loss cost inflation that may or may not be contemplated today is of course a concern with the class. What you do there is you focus on terms and conditions, you focus on attachment points, you focus on, you know, limit deployment. We have, again, not every answer is reinsurance, but we're only willing to take, you know, a certain amount net depending on the gross limit deployed, which is much, you know, smaller than what the historical, you know, portfolio would look like. So some of that emergence became from, yeah, maybe it wasn't great underwriting, but it also was significant net limit retention. That gets you in trouble when you have, you know, sort of vertical exposure and hadn't fully contemplated. So I do think that there are going to be pockets of industry, you know, classes that we will push pretty hard for claims made. I don't think it's going to be a predominant trend within the industry. You know, some companies are trying to put stuff together. I don't know what the take-up is. I don't think it's significant. But you have to really manage that through underwriting with the terms and conditions and focusing on, you know, how much limit you're willing to deploy, and are you following someone? We lead, we set the terms. That's really important.
Okay, no, that's
and I think helpful. With our reinsurance, the other thing too is not that, you know, I sat up here, whatever, 5 years ago, you know, and you're 2 to 3 years into it, you gotta play it out. But like, we're like in year 8 or 9 in terms of taking low nets within, you know, within casualty. We started, you know, sort of in 18, 19, but we also did the unearned portion of the book. And so we just don't have big attachment, big retentions. We have lower attachment points. And so as each year goes on, you're going to get more and more confidence in terms of how we think about, you know, ultimates, certainly on the back years, but even on some of the more, you know, recent years.
Okay. No, that's very helpful.
I mean, I'm speaking to an actuary, so it's dangerous, but...
well, it's also boring.
But that's my view.
But yeah, no, we're trying to get the sense, and I think it's been pointed out that, you know, there are a number of periodicals focused on the insurance industry, and sometimes it's tricky to filter out when they have these stories, is this a real shift or is this a one-off? So I think that insight is very,
like,
very helpful.
Well, I mean, like, you got to do the work. Like, you look at companies, again, you go through Schedule P and see whose loss ratios held up, you know, from their original, even go out, like, you know, whatever, the, you know, go through, you know, 2015, start year 2, say everybody got year 1 wrong, 15, 16, like, you can see companies that traditionally get it wrong.
Yeah.
Like, and you see companies that traditionally get it right. Like, and so I think that's important in terms of, you know, experience, looking at triangles, understanding, again, limit deployment and potential ultimates, and it's a complicated line.
And not to jump too far afield from what you're saying, but one of these analyses I've been working on, and this is not going to come as a surprise to anyone, is that the best predictor of whether a company will have adverse development on accident year X is if they did the prior year. So it, you know, for me, it all fits into why I don't trust book value as a valuation metric, but your point is something that I'm more than happy to say I've seen.
Yeah, book value is as good as the quality of the reserves, right? Like, and so if you have a view of what, you know, ultimate looks like, then you'd have a good view of book value.
Which may not be what companies are saying.
Correct.
Where are we on global personal in terms of the shift to an MGA model, the shift to adequate pricing, and what are the long-term prospects?
So are we talking high net worth or like just the general global personal?
So I was going to ask about both, starting off on the
I would say if you start with the sort of bigger one, which is you know, global personal, I would say very good businesses. You know, we've divested businesses that we didn't think were core. We need to grow A&H more. It's profitable, but it has not grown to the level it needs to grow. We have to have a little bit more profitability improvement in the personal, defined as personal auto and homeowners, that we do in international, not necessarily in the U.S. But the big, you know, bet is going to be, can we, you know, get the high net worth and PCS to profitability? And we will. It's been slower than I would have liked, just in terms of some of the headwinds that have existed. You know, changing, you know, a model that, you know, I still believe the way we've structured this will work out in the long term. But we need other carriers, you know, to be, you know, working with us in the MGA to be able to, you know, underwrite the business alongside AIG. That was the real driver of the quota share, which will, you know, we'll see negative growth in, you know, in 2025. But that is bringing in strategic partners that are going to learn more about the business that will either provide paper or will come off business. I mean, we don't need the quota share for, you know, reinsurance ceded or, you know, look, it's a benefit in the short run on profitability because the ceding commission is higher than the expenses. We were able to lower the MGA expenses and get a enhanced ceding commission. Okay, so what? That's a 400 or 500 basis point benefit. That's not going to be, you know, long-term business strategy. But I do think that the opportunity is going to be seen. We're growing in E&S more than we are in admitted, of course, but not as much as we need to. You know, we have been off to a slower start than I would have liked. And in the rest of, you know, 25 and as we get into 26, we're going to have to accelerate that. You know, that growth, or, you know, think about going more into an open market environment, you know, where we can see, you know, more submission activity. So it's working. The profitability improvement is there. It's happening this year, but the absolute performance of the high net worth business is not where we want to be. But we're heading in the right direction.
Okay. Once the profitability has been addressed. What's the global market potential of high net worth homeowners, high net worth personal lines?
We won't go outside the U.S. I wouldn't expect to see that strategically in the next 3 years. I think the opportunity is, I'm going to give you a number and then you can hold me to it, but I think it's substantial. I mean, I still believe that going into the, sort of E&S environment, problem with admitted is if you're in the ultra high net worth or high net worth, you have to put out, large policy limits. The accumulation and cat exposure gets pretty heavy very fast. If you look at areas that have always been problematic, there's been, more TIV in those areas. Think of Florida, Texas, California, all have different dynamics. I still think the Northeast is the most exposed because of how weak the PMLs are and the TIVs are massive. Mm-hmm. And also, if a Category 3 ever found its way up this way, flooding, construction type, we're not ready for it. There could be things that happen that accelerate it. But I think it's, the opportunity over a longer period of time is well within the hundreds of millions, maybe, even greater than that.
Okay.
Because I just think that the void isn't getting filled. You hear, anecdotes, but they're real, which is, we've seen, I'm not gonna call it a trend yet, but let me get through the full year. But even with what was happening with the wildfires is looking at, sort of claims development, because you wanna be observant on inflation, supply issues. Is there more demand or replacement costs? What does it look like? I mean, a lot more of our clients took the check and aren't rebuilding. And so forget it. I'm not doing this because I can't get insurance and I'm not going to be in a place where, there's going to be more, wildfires not protected. That's not really solving a problem. I think, again, we haven't seen something significant in Florida. I think there's more limit to be purchased and there's more demand, if we are there to offer the product.
Okay, fantastic. I had one. And again, if there are questions in the room, please let me know. But I want to focus on investment income. You talked in the Investor Day, and again, not abruptly, but taking more risk. Where are we on that process? How should we think about the timeline?
I didn't say that. I think Keith said that.
Hi, Keith.
What we are alluding to is that when we were fixing the underwriting side, we were also very conscientious of being conservative on the investment side. And so we went from, when we were part of, AIG was Life Retirement and, PNC, the General Insurance, we had $325 billion of AUM. And then we began to say, okay, is an outsourcing model more advantageous? Well, knowing we were splitting up, I'm not going to spend time talking about Corbridge, but, we had Blackstone, come in, Nippon come in. We outsourced a lot of the fixed income to BlackRock, both Corbridge and AIG. But, when you're $100 billion or thereabouts of AUM, developing a more outsourced model, not for the investment strategy, not for the asset allocation, but for the execution, mm-hmm. we felt was a appropriate model. And that's what we did, and I think it's worked out really well. Now, along the way, we started to get out of hedge funds, we started to get out of some of the alternatives, and Keith has been, working with the head of our investments, Pat Bovaire, in terms of repositioning, the alts or the reinvestment that we've had in fixed income. And so I think there is an opportunity for us because we were so conservative in terms of the overall percentage of asset allocation alternatives, that there's ways in which we can get, perhaps not chasing it, but just executing better with a more balanced strategy where we can get a little bit more, return. 3.8 years, not the longest duration, it's not like life, but it's also not that complex.
Okay, and then last chance to, as I look around the room, and if not, I am going to thank Peter. Please join me in thanking Peter for a very informative session.
Thanks, Grant.
Thank you so much.